Years before the current popularity of world music, David Lewiston was traveling around the world with one of the first portable stereo tape recorders. He's recorded the tantric chants of Tibetan monks, traditional songs of Kashmir, kabuki music of Japan, fiesta music of the high Andes, classical music of Iran, and Balinese gamelan music. 28 of his records are included in the Explorer series on Nonesuch Records. The series has been perhaps the most popular and influential collection of its kind. Several of Lewiston's records have just been reissued on compact disc. Lewiston studied at the Trinity College of Music in London, but he was introduced to music from around the world years later in New York by his teacher Thomas de Hartmann, a composer close to the spiritual teacher G.I. Gurdjieff. Lewiston made his first recordings in 1966 in Java and Bali. He returned to Bali in 1987, and the music he recorded has just been released on the new record Bali. This piece was recorded at the opening parade of the Bali Arts Festival. Lewiston, welcome to Fresh Air. Can you describe the music that we're listening to? Put it into a context for us.
Yes, every year, in the middle of the year, that means June, July, there's a month-long festival of performing arts in Bali. And in 87, when I was there, it began on June the 13th. And there was a huge procession through Denpasar, which is Bali's capital. I counted something like 40 different groups waiting to go in the procession, all attired in their best traditional Balinese costume, and groups playing their traditional instruments. And this is music from that parade. What we listened to was music of the Balaganger, which is the Balinese marching band, which plays procession music. And as you heard, there are gongs and drums and instruments of that sort.
This new record from Bali that you recorded features gamelan music. Would you explain what gamelan music is?
Well, not to get too technical about it, the Balinese have many highly sophisticated ensembles which feature metal instruments. That means metallophones, gongs, and other instruments of that sort. So most gamelans consist of metal instruments. There are also some that feature bamboo instruments, but metal is much more prevalent these days.
One of the first records that you made for the Explorer series featured Balinese gamelan music. What brought you to Bali the first time around?
Oh, I suppose everybody's travel fantasy. That was in 1966, and I had a respectable job in New York, and I was just lusting for travel, and Bali was very much at the top of the list, so that's where I headed when I was able to get a few weeks off.
How have things changed since your return visit in the mid-80s?
Well, I didn't go back for 20 years because I kept on hearing these stories of how tourism had ruined Bali. But eventually in 86, I thought, well, it's time to take a look for myself. So I went back and spent 6 weeks looking around the island. I found, yes, it's true. The parts of the island are crawling with tourists. But luckily, the Balinese have been skillful in putting the tourists into a few small areas. It's not all over the island. In fact, if one goes outside these tourist ghettos, the traditional Bali still exists.
On your liner notes for your new record of music from Bali, you say that it's become harder to record music there now. What's made it harder?
Noise. There are motorbikes everywhere on even the narrowest country lane. And there are so many dogs now, it's really hard to find a quiet place for recording. Also, because of the increase in commerce in the island, you know, tourism, et cetera, and Westerners doing clothing business and what have you, everybody is very much busier, so it's harder to get people together now.
Mm-hmm. I want to play another selection from your new music, your new album of music from Bali, and this is a gamelan gong, which means what?
Well, gong is for the big gongs, which are more than a meter in diameter and which add much of the glory of the sound to a large gamelan.
Now, this is a recent piece, not a traditional piece.
Yes, a recently composed piece, but in traditional style.
Is there anything you'd like to say about it before we hear it?
Well, just that it proves that the Balinese music is alive and well. This piece is, you know, as good as any of the more traditional gamelan gong pieces which were composed 30 or 40 or 50 years ago. And I think it's reassuring to know that there's no problem with the health of music in Bali today.
Let's hear it. An excerpt from a recent composition recorded by David Lewiston from his album, new album of music, From Bali, on the Nonesuch Explorer series. And David Lewiston has recorded around 28 albums for this Nonesuch Explorer series, starting with his work in the mid-1960s. David Lewiston, when you started doing this work in the 1960s, it was before the current popular interest in world music. People today are celebrating the cross-pollination of music the way musicians in Africa and South America and other parts of the world are listening to rock and jazz and incorporating that in with their traditional music. I wonder how you feel about that, seeing musics from around the world cross-pollinating.
Well, I must say that when I hear people using the Balinese materials, very rarely do I find the result distinguished. Usually it sounds like mishmash to me.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that a distinguished musician will express his or her quality in whatever he or she does, but, you know, regrettably, a lot of what I've heard just doesn't turn me on.
Is it getting more difficult to find music that has remained in its tradition as the mass media penetrates even the most remote regions?
Well, yes, in the Himalayas, for example, there's the Indian filmy music. That's the Indian pop music just about everywhere because all India radio is broadcasting and all over India. So in remote mountain communities, I have to take great care to find a knowledgeable informant who can nudge me if the artist we're recording suddenly starts to sing pop music instead of the real local thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have a special interest in conserving the music and the rituals of Tibetan Buddhism. The Tibetan Buddhists are living in exile in India. How did this become a special interest of yours?
Well, in 72, my romantic fantasy at that time was the Himalayas. So I took off from New York and went to India and had the good fortune to go to two monasteries that had absolutely gorgeous chanting. One was Jutta and the other was a monastery called Tashijong, which were located, about 150 miles one from the other. And at Tashijong, I had the very great good fortune to become friends with the late Kantor Rinpoche, who was the abbot of the monastery. He was a true Renaissance man, a revered guru, but also an expert in sacred dance, sacred music, a fine painter of tonkas. He even designed the temple when they got the money to build it. And I remember sitting with him one day in his quarters while he was laying out with charcoal the decoration for the inside of the temple. And he was a wonderful man, a great loss when he died about 10 years ago. So the rituals at Tashijong reflect his quality and the quality he was able to imbue in the monks who were with him.
Now, I want to play something that you recorded that's featured on an album called Tibetan Buddhism, The Ritual, Orchestra, and Chants. And we're going to tell us about what we're going to hear.
Well, this is an invocation of Padmasambhava, the tantric master who carried Buddhism to Tibet in the 8th century. He's revered by Tibetans as a very Buddha, and the respect and love that the Tibetans feel for Padmasambhava is reflected in this invocation of him.
Now, musically, what we're going to hear is going to start with chanting and one handbell, and the handbells gradually build. Ritualistically, what's that about?
No, well, essentially, they're just reciting a text of praise to Padmasambhava, mm-hmm. and then this is some of the accompaniment of the song of praise, quite simply that. When there are instrumental interludes, which occur from time to time, I've had great trouble in getting anybody to explain exactly what is going on. And the usual explanation when there are just instruments playing is it's an offering. And when I say, well, what do you mean by an offering? They say, well, in the sense that everything is an offering to the Buddha. I don't know whether that helps.
Okay, yeah. Well, let's hear this. David Lewiston, are you ever considered an intruder when you set up with your microphones in a Tibetan monastery?
No, because it's all discussed ahead of time. I go in and I meet the abbot and explain what it is I'd like to do and ask for his views and find out that what he feels needs to be recorded. I mean, I'm not the big expert. They're the big experts. I just go in and try to be useful.
Now, a lot of this music is music of transformation in a way. I mean, it's these chants and invocations, I think, help the people almost reach an altered state of consciousness. I'm wondering what it's like for you to be there, you know, watching the recording levels as all this mystical experience is happening around you.
Well, you know, I think mystical experience makes things sound a little bit too fuzzy. Mm-hmm. I much prefer the way the Dalai Lama explains it, and that's pretty much in terms of the union of wisdom and compassion, with the emphasis very much on compassion. There was one great occasion when he was talking in Vancouver, and one of the Westerners there said, you know, Rinpoche, it's all very confusing. Can you make it simple for us? And he just looked around, gave a big smile and said, be kind to one another. And so I feel that essentially the transformation that is looked for here is in the opening towards compassion. And if we talk in terms of altered states of consciousness, that's missing sight of the main point.
Mm-hmm. I want to play another excerpt of music that you recorded at a Tibetan monastery. This is from an album of yours that's just been reissued on CD. The album's called Tibetan Buddhism, Tantras of Gyuto, Sangwadupa, and Mahakala. Now, this is the kind of Tibetan chanting in which each of the monks can sing about three notes at the same time, so each person can sing a chord, basically.
It's more an overtone structure that's coming through. What happens is they're producing a very profound low bass note, and the way the vocal chords are being used, there are such strong resonances in the upper register that it sounds as though each monk is in fact producing a chord. Yes.
This is a very difficult technique to learn. Do the monks have to go through a long training period to master this technique?
Tara Rinpoche, I recorded this in 72, and when I asked Tara Rinpoche, who was then the abbot of Gyuto, about this, he said it took typically about 3 years to learn. And because of the nature of the bass sounds that are required, only mature monks can do it. The younger ones cannot, because their voices aren't mature enough.
Well, it's a really awe-inspiring sound. Let's listen to this kind of chanting with overtones performed by Tibetan monks. David Lewiston, I know that some people, if they were recording music such as the Tibetan chanting that we just heard, they'd want to learn how to do it, you know? Are you ever tempted to try to master these techniques yourself or to sit in with the musicians, as I know some people who travel around the world do? Or do you think that that would be totally inappropriate for you?
Well, I tried once or twice. My friends at Gyuto tried very hard to help me, but I wasn't much good at all, so... I felt better not to embarrass myself and them.
Do you think it helps you to keep a distance like that, or do you ever wish that you could get more musically involved with the proceedings?
No, I'm content with what I'm doing. You know, I enjoy the energy of these places. I enjoy being with my friends in the monasteries, and you know what they do is what they do, and fooling around with mics and recording equipment is what I do.
Mm-hmm. When you started recording music around the world in the 1960s, you weren't a trained ethnomusicologist. How did you see the work you were doing compared to the trained ethnomusicologists who were also going to some of the same regions you were?
Well, first of all, I approached this as a trained musician, not as a scholar. And my interest is essentially that of a musician, you know, in finding something gorgeous and then sharing it with other people. I think my approach is much more that of a communicator, a musical journalist, if you like, rather than that of a scholar.
Mm-hmm. In the early days, when you'd pick up and go to a country to find music, did you have any idea where you were going and where you would find the music?
No, none.
So you'd get someplace and ask around?
That's right, uh-huh. Sure. You know, just go around and meet people and... if one is asking, well, you know, which are the best musicians, people who are interested in the arts are normally people of goodwill and very willing to help.
Now, you seldom record in the studio.
Well, it depends. I actually don't use studios. I use the appropriate locale. In Bali, it's outdoors because the music is meant to be played outdoors. With my Tibetan friends, I record in the temples because that ambiance is appropriate to the material.
Mm-hmm. And your Bali record, one piece opens with a rooster crowing. On a lot of the pieces, you hear crickets or cicadas in the background.
That's right, yes.
And you want that kind of ambience.
Oh, absolutely. I think that without it, the music would be sterile and it would it would take away an essential quality. In fact, when Bob Ludwig did the mix for this newest project, we very carefully brought up the levels at the beginning, before each cut actually began, so that the ambient sound would be there, so that the audience would have a feeling of being in the situation.
David Lewiston, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your travels around the world and the music you've recorded.
I enjoyed, and I hope that our friends who are listening to this have as much enjoyment listening to music as I did recording it.